Hey everybody, if you want to tell the world something or sell the world something, head on over to Squarespace because they're going to help you build the website of your dreams. Say you want to sell some custom merch. Well, you can set up your online store. Whether you sell physical, digital, or service products, Squarespace has the tools you need to start selling online. So go to squarespace.com/stuff right now and you will face a free trial. And when you get ready to launch, use our offer code STUFF and then you'll save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. How could you go wrong with Squarespace?
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. I don't know if you've heard, but we have a book coming out. Finally, after all these years. It's great. It's fun. You're going to love it. It's called Stuff You Should Know, an incomplete compendium of mostly interesting things.
Yep. And it's 26 jam-packed chapters that we wrote with another guy named Nils Parker, who's amazing and is illustrated amazingly by our illustrator, Carly Minardo. And it's just an all-around joy to pick up and read. Even though we haven't physically held in our hands yet, it's like we have, Chuck, in our dreams so far.
I can't wait to actually see and hold this thing and smell it. And so should you. So pre-order now. It means a lot to us. The support is a very big deal. So pre-order anywhere books are sold.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, and welcome to Pump Up the Volume. I'm Josh. There's Chuck. Jerry's out there somewhere, raging against the machine. And this is, we'll just say it's Stuff You Should Know.
I love it. When I sent you this this research, you were like, the first thing you said was Pump Up the Volume.
Sure, man. That's such a great movie.
You know what's funny is I didn't think about that once until you said that. And I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was all about piracy and radios.
Yeah, I love that movie. I just hadn't seen it in, I don't know, I don't think probably since then.
It has a really, has a good soundtrack. It has Bad Brains and Henry Rollins.
Yeah.
Doing Kick Out the Jams,
yeah.
The MC5 song. It also has probably the best Soundgarden song of all time, Heretic.
Well, it's tough to call for me as a Soundgarden nut, but yeah, good song.
It is a good song. Which one's better than that?
I like a lot of Soundgarden, so.
Yeah?
I have probably 20 tied for first songs.
Okay, but is that one of them?
Yeah, it's up there.
Oh, thanks for that.
I love it. It's great. I mean, I love all Soundgarden songs.
Sure. Yeah, I guess I do too now that I think about it. I think it could have had something to do with Chris Cornell's voice to an extent.
Oh, man. R.I.P.
Yeah, for real.
I used to joke about the imagining the first time that he like sung in the shower when he was 13 or something.
He was like, wow. He'd
be like, oh, I think I know what I'm going to do for a living.
Yeah, exactly. Shower. So we're talking about Pump Up the Volume and Chris Cornell right now because this episode is about pirate radio. And specifically, it's about the British pirate radio invasion of the 60s that I had no idea about. I've never seen that movie, Pirate Radio, but I intend to now. Have you seen it?
I haven't seen the movie, but I was acquainted with the story somehow. I think I might have seen a short documentary or something about the Caroline, and really, really cool stuff.
It is, which is why we're going to talk about it in this episode.
Yeah.
But I just found the whole thing, I don't know if mind-blowing is the right word, but certainly deeply interesting. And I think it's cool because it's one of those like pieces to the jigsaw puzzle of history, at least like rock history, that you didn't even realize, like you didn't have, you know? And
yeah.
By you, I mean me.
Yeah, and here's the thing, is there were other pirate radio stations all around the world, and there always have been since there's been radio and restrictions on radio, but
hey, and as long as there's rock, Chuck, there always will be.
That's true, but the UK version was sort of the most celebrated and the most famous, I think, obviously why they made a movie about it. And one of the reasons is because the man whose thumb they were under was the BBC, which is a big deal.
It was a big deal because here in the United States, and I know ahoy to all of you listeners outside of the United States who you're like, well, yeah, we this is what it was like. In the United States, the radio spectrum has always been very free, or it was intended to be very free, to where there was a multiplicity of voices and you could say a lot of stuff. It got a little stodgy, and it was kind of stodgy from the outset. But for the most part, it wasn't just one monolithic organization that controlled all of the radio waves. That's just not how it's been in the States. And in places like the UK, that's how it was basically right out of the gate. They said, you know, this is a really valuable tool. You can really shape people's minds with this. So we're going to leave it specifically under government control. Look, we'll provide a bunch of different stuff. Not everything you want, but a lot of stuff, especially if you're a stodgy, conservative, old establishment type, you're going to love what we're pumping out. But the point is it's too important to just kind of let anybody come along who has the money for a radio license to just set up a radio station. That seems absurd. Only the loony colonies would do something like that.
Yeah, so the BBC had a very vice-like grip, like you were saying, for, geez, about 40-something years. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the 60s come along, and like so many other things in America and the UK, kids that were born of these World War II, I guess you would call them baby boomers
sure.
or boomers, the babies of those boomers, were rock and roll kids. You know, they grew up seeing Elvis and the Beatles on television, mm-hmm. and they were not square like their parents were, and they had different ideas than their parents did. And this was the case in England in the 1960s when the BBC was, you know, rock and roll was a thing, and they were like, we're not playing this devil's music. They probably didn't say that. That was more American.
Well, it was certainly controversial. Songs that seemed to us like, I mean, like you just hear them on an elevator today, like they were highly controversial back then, you know? And like there was genuinely nowhere on the radio in the UK for you to reliably turn to hear this stuff. You had to go to like a club, to hear them, and those were few and far between. And then if you were lucky enough, you might be able to occasionally dial in Radio Luxembourg, which played some of these like pop hits, but they were also, it was still largely controlled by a few record labels. So it didn't just, they didn't go deep. It was still like whatever new big band they were trying to promote, but it was still way cooler than anything the BBC was promoting. The problem is the reception was certainly spotty.
You ever been to Luxembourg?
I have not. I may have passed through it and not known it
because
I blinked, but I don't believe I have.
It's so under the radar. I flew out of there once. That's the only time I've been to Luxembourg is flew home from Europe out of Luxembourg airport. So that's my only – like I don't know anything about it as a place. It's interesting. It's like the Delaware of Europe.
That's right. It may or may not exist.
Yeah.
So that was pretty much the long and short of it. And the BBC didn't really care that the teenagers wanted more. They just said no. They might have even said nine at this point. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and this is where a gentleman comes in the picture that would really change everything. And his name is Ronan, and I've heard Americans pronounce it O'Reilly.
Yeah.
It's spelled O, little accent, capital R-A-H-I-L-L-Y. And I heard him speak his name in court when they asked his surname, but he said it so quickly, it sounded like O'Dolly. It sounded like a D, so it may just be like some weird, like, you know, Irish pronunciation or something that I don't know about.
Sure.
But we're going to say O'Reilly.
I mean, that's how I heard it too. But yeah, so he sounded like Brad Pitt in Snatch. So,
yeah, sort of. I couldn't understand him. I swear there was a D in there. But he was a guy who figured out that their jurisdiction over the airwaves, the BBC and the UK government's jurisdiction, stopped about 5 kilometers off the coast, 3 miles here in the States. And he said, and he didn't invent the idea of planning a boat out there and broadcasting. Other countries were doing this kind of thing and exploiting this loophole already. But he said, this is something we should do. The kids want their rock and roll. They want their MTV. We don't know what that is yet. And I'm going to bring it to them.
Yeah, so he actually took inspiration. Like you were saying, there are some Scandinavian countries, specifically Sweden and Denmark, that had been home to pirate radio stations that were docked off of their coast. And for very similar reasons, too. There was a state monopoly on radio broadcasting at the time. And some people were like, no, that's I want to broadcast what I want to broadcast.
Right.
And so they set up those shops, I mean, all the way back in the 50s. And I actually ran across one in the United States to bring it on home that was operating in the 1930s, 1933. And it had a call sign, RXKR, and it was out of Panama, even though it was off of the coast of Long Beach. And I think, Chuck, I think we either talked about it in our Prohibition episode or we talked about it in our Who Owns the Oceans episode.
Oh, yeah.
But it was originally one of those floating speakeasy casinos.
That's
docked
right.
In international waters.
Totally.
And then they started to broadcast radio, pirate radio as well for a little while. So it had happened before. And there was actually, because of the success of the Scandinavian stations, there was kind of this mad rush in the UK to be the first to see, I guess, and start broadcasting. And Ronan O'Reilly beat them all with what came to be known as Radio Caroline.
Yeah, so he was sort of in a tight race with another guy named Alan Crawford, mm-hmm. who had a project called, his was going to be Radio Atlanta. I think it was called Project Atlanta. Nothing to do with Atlanta, Georgia.
Atlanta, Texas, from what I saw.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
I figured it was just a riff on Atlantic, as in the ocean.
No, one of the owners was from Dallas, I believe, is a radio man from Texas, and for some reason he chose Atlanta after Atlanta, Texas.
I didn't know there wasn't Atlanta, Texas.
I didn't either. Neither did the people who live in Atlanta, Texas.
So they're the Delaware of Texas.
That's right.
So there was, I think O'Reilly got about a half a dozen investors because this is going to cost some money because you got to buy a ship. It can't just be a little dinghy or a rowboat or anything like that. You have to
takes a shipload of equipment.
Yeah, it takes and people to operate it and people to stay on it and stuff like that and meeting rooms mm-hmm. and so you got to have a legit ship. So Crawford for Radio Atlanta got the Mi Amigo, and O'Reilly got a passenger ferry, a Danish ship called the MV Frederica. Mm-hmm. They each renamed them Atlanta and then Caroline, respectively. Apparently, yeah. Caroline after Caroline Kennedy, because he, as lore goes, O'Reilly saw a photo of little Caroline and little John Jr. dancing in the Oval Office. And he was inspired by that because he was like, this is what we're trying to do. Like, sort of, you know, you're not allowed to dance in the Oval Office, yet they're doing it. And we're not allowed to broadcast rock and roll music because the government says so. So, you know, I'm going to name after Caroline. Very cute name.
It is very cute. So that's the name that he went with. And I'm glad that he was one of the I'm glad he was the one who made it first, because he was the one who was doing it, I guess, as purely as you would expect somebody to be doing, with like a constant rotation of DJs operating 24 hours a day, legitimately broadcasting from the ship. And that was not Radio Atlanta's model at all. They were compiling shows or days worth of shows in the studio back in London,
boo.
Recording them and then sailing it out to the ship. There was like banking concerns that were invested in it. It was illegit as far as pirate radio goes from the outset. So I'm glad that they weren't the ones who made it to market first.
Yeah, so Radio Caroline, their slogan was your all-day music station because of that 24/7 format.
Mm-hmm. And, which was new in and of itself, right?
Yeah, as far as playing music, absolutely. And they just, within a few months, I think they launched on Easter Sunday, 1964, with the Stones tune, It's All Over Now. Perfect.
I saw Not Fade Away.
I saw It's All Over Now, actually.
I saw in The Guardian and then one other source, Not Fade Away. And then I also saw All Over Now, but I saw both. In enough legit places that I honestly don't know.
Yeah, I saw Not Fade Away was the station's theme song. So who knows? And then they got someone else to compose an original theme song mm-hmm. because I think they didn't want to keep playing that. But at any rate, they launched. And it didn't take long until they had a larger audience than all of the BBC stations combined.
That's wonderful.
And they quickly merged. I think if it goes from Easter Sunday, they merged in July, just a few months later with Radio Atlanta. I guess they figured they had just more power together. And then the Mi Amigo, they became the Caroline North and the Caroline South, broadcasting from two different places.
Yeah, which covered almost all of the UK, but not all of it. There was some southwestern parts that just didn't get it from either ship.
The Delaware.
But they had pretty good coverage of the Isles for sure with those two ships. And then eventually Radio Atlanta went under as an organization, and Radio Caroline was able to take over both of those ships. So they had that. For a pirate radio station, they had a lot of power behind them for sure.
Yeah, and we haven't said the obvious. They were called pirate radio because they were operating on ships in the ocean.
And flouting the law.
Yeah, so it was sort of doing double duty there with the name.
Yeah, there's actually some really great pieces out there on the internet about this era.
Yeah.
And one of them I saw was they said, like, from the moment they started broadcasting, it was basically immediately called pirate radio. For some reason, those two words together just seem—they just strike something in you, you know?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And there's lots of cool documentaries, too, in addition to the narrative film, which obviously takes a lot of liberties, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But a lot of cool short documentaries and even longer documentaries.
You want to take an ad break?
Yeah, true pirates.
Right. We'll be right back, everybody. Hey, everybody, it's time you heard about Squarespace. Squarespace has the tools you need to create and sell your own website. Whether it's an online course or custom merch, Squarespace has you covered.
That's right. Courses is a great program. You can start with a professional layout that fits your brand, upload video lessons to teach techniques and skills, and tailor your course with a powerful Fluid Engine editor.
That's right. With Fluid Engine, which is a next-generation website design system, by the way, it's never been easier for anyone to unlock unbreakable creativity.
That's right. And don't forget the commerce side, because after that, you can charge a one-time fee or you can even sell a subscription.
Yeah. So turn your creativity into income with Squarespace courses. And right now, go to squarespace.com/stuff for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code STUFF to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Squarespace. Hey, everybody, we're here to tell you about Viator, a tool that you can use to plan and book travel experiences around the world.
That's right. The Viator app and website make it easy to explore 300,000 plus travel experiences so you can discover what's out there no matter where you're traveling or what you're interested in.
Yep, Viator can help you plan better travel experiences. 300,000 plus travel experiences to choose from means you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy.
That's right. You can also enjoy real traveler reviews to get insider information from people who've already been on the experience that you're considering. Plus, you get free cancellation that helps you plan for the unexpected.
Yeah, and Viator offers 24/7 customer service, so you know you'll get support at any hour if things aren't going as planned. So download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find the perfect travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator. All right, we're back. Hopefully those were the bossest ads you've ever heard.
Yeah, I'm sure they were very subversive.
Yep.
and flouting
anti-establishment.
Yeah, exactly.
So Radio Caroline's up and running. And when I said earlier, Chuck, that there was like a it represents a piece of the puzzle of rock and roll history, even pop culture history, that I didn't realize I didn't know existed. But when I said that, I meant this specific group of pirate radio stations, but really Radio Caroline, from what I can tell, had such a pronounced effect on music that they actually managed to reshape it and rechange it, because the BBC was basically saying, we're only playing stodgy stuff your parents like. Like, literally square records. That's how square the music we're playing is. There's no place for you bands to play the music you want to play. So you have to make music that we will play on BBC. And all of a sudden now, there was this really potent outlet that hadn't existed before. And those bands that had started out kind of prim and BBC ready were now able to start taking acid like on a daily basis and really explore like their musical abilities and try new things. And they knew that there was a good chance that it would get played on Radio Caroline or some of the other pirate radio stations. And in that, it actually shaped psychedelia. It shaped the psychedelic music scene by just giving it a place to start.
Yeah, I mean, they had to fill, it says here, about 2,500 songs each week because they were going 24/7.
That was each DJ that had to.
Yeah, and that's a lot of music. And, you know, you didn't want to just play the same stuff over and over. They wanted to follow, and they could follow, the American Top 40 sort of system where you play the hits and you play the hits a little more, but then you also try and break new music. And this How Stuff Works article says the Moody Blues were a band that kind of came directly out of pirate radio as far as being broken on pirate radio, starting to do experimental stuff and that wouldn't obviously get played on the BBC anywhere.
But having started out as playing music that would get played on the BBC and then being allowed to kind of alter to what they wanted to be.
Totally.
And one of the song I saw that's widely considered the first pirate radio hit of the swinging 60s in the UK is Tom Jones' It's Not Unusual.
Yeah, good song.
Now, that is unusual as far as facts go.
You think?
That makes the Carlton dance 1 degree removed from British 60s pirate radio. I would not have seen that connection before.
Yeah, and I mean, you hear It's Not Unusual. It's a cool song, and Tom Jones was a cool dude.
Yeah.
But it definitely feels way more square to my ears now than early psychedelia.
For sure. I mean, sure, the whole thing is from front to back about smoking hash and how much Tom Jones loved his hash. But still today, it seems a little tame for sure.
Yeah, he was so great. He's Welsh, right?
I don't know. Probably.
I think he's Welsh.
Okay, we'll go with that.
So one of the big DJs, and they had a whole rotation of DJs that all loved what they did, and most of them went on to be DJs for life. Some stayed with Radio Caroline for life. I guess that's the sort of spoiler, is that they're still around today, and you can listen to them on the internet and on the radio, even though they have a legal license now. But I was listening to their stream. You can stream sort of the classic version, which is music from back then, and it's just fantastic. It's like a good WFMU playlist. If you ever remember, we were on FMU for a while, the classic New Jersey freeform radio station that's so great.
They clearly had some space to fill too.
Yeah, so I encourage you to go listen to Radio Caroline and check it out. But one of the more famous DJs to come out of that scene was Tony Blackburn. Mm-hmm. And he was a fan of Radio Luxembourg just as a listener, and saw an ad in the NME, New Musical Express, still a great magazine.
Sure. It's been around since the 50s, I read.
Oh, it's fantastic. That and Melody Maker are two of the best. And he basically applied for this job, got it, and became one of the more popular DJs on that ship.
Yeah, he was one. I mean, kind of going down through history, Pete Tong started out on pirate radio. He's a very well-known DJ. And supposedly also, I think we mentioned him in the Cockney Rhyming Slang episode.
Yeah.
Where everything's gone all wrong. It's gone Pete Tong.
Uh-huh.
Well, yeah, we definitely did, because we talked about that. It's better than nothing, I think. And then there was another very famous DJ. His name
Jazzy
was,
Jeff?
Yeah. I'm the DJ. He's the rapper. Remember that? They had to explain it to everybody on one of their... the guy I'm thinking of is DJ Andy Archer.
Okay.
And he is a very well-known DJ, has been for many, many years. I think he started out in the 60s. I don't know if it was on Caroline or Radio London, one of the competitors, but he is known to have coined the term anorak. And in the UK, I didn't know this, but anorak is slang for like a super nerdy, obsessive fan, basically.
Uh-huh.
And the term was coined because Andy Archer called some of the nerdy male radio, pirate radio fans who were like so obsessed with the whole thing, they would actually hire boats to take them out to the ships that were broadcasting. They would normally wear like anoraks because of the weather. So an anorak apparently gets its origin from pirate radio too.
Well, and that's one of the cool things about the early days of pirate radio is they didn't have ratings to depend on.
Mm-hmm.
They got their feedback from kind of like us, from hearing from people. We get it via email and stuff like that, but they got bags and bags of mail.
Just like us.
People would stop by their office, like you said, by boat. That's happened to us before.
Yeah.
Even though it's, you know, not encouraged any longer, and especially now during the lockdown.
Right.
There's no one here. But people would show up. They would send them gifts. I think Blackburn was the one that said he would tell listeners that when he got back to land and he would drive away in his little sports car, that he would give away just, you know, records. He would give away 45s and this obsolete vinyl. And he said it would take him an hour and a half to get out of town just because he was mobbed by kids on the street looking for him, looking to get a piece of him, looking to get one of those records. It was like true fandom.
I read something about Tony Blackburn that apparently he once did a live performance of Tie a Yellow Ribbon Round the Old Oak Tree in a cage full of lions with a lion tamer.
It's a very psychedelic song.
It is. Isn't that weird?
Yeah. Why?
I don't know. I think that's just Tony Blackburn. That's the impression I have.
Another DJ was an American named Mike Pasternak.
Mm-hmm.
His DJ name was Emperor Roscoe. And he still sort of apparently wears this skull and crossbones baseball hat. And I get a feeling all these people, like, this is their cred. They still really hang their hat on this experiences, like these rock and roll mavericks from the 60s.
Right. That's the impression I have, too. But the thing is like, you know, I think most people assume that these ships were just, like, party boats, basically. And from what I can tell, that's just not the case at all, that they were largely staffed by professional acting DJs, even though a lot of them were not professionals at all. Like you said, was it Blackburn that had he answered an ad in the New Musical Express?
Blackburn did. Pasternak, the American, was he had a little bit of experience with military radio on an aircraft carrier.
Right, and, 2 years.
Yeah, and thought he brought sort of a polish that the British guys didn't have. He said they didn't have the technique yet. But yeah, by all accounts, they were pros. They weren't like in the movie. I think they really play it up as just sort of a big party barge.
Sure. Which, I mean, that's a movie kind of thing to do for sure.
And they were allowed apparently only 2 beers a day. And they could play cards. They could watch TV. They could sunbathe. And I think Pasternak said occasionally some women would come aboard for a cup of tea. So, you know, we'll I don't know if that story is fully true, but
I don't either. I think they actually did have tea with some of the anoraks that showed up.
Probably so.
So we've got Radio Caroline. It's operating. It's going pretty well. But there was an incident that went down, I think in 1966, maybe 67, which kind of goes to show you, like, Radio Caroline is this huge smash success, and it's allowed to operate, flouting the laws of the UK for a few years before the UK government finally said enough is enough. And they passed something called the Marine Broadcasting Offenses Act. And supposedly the thing that really prompted them to take action was that there was a hostile physical takeover of one of the pirate radio stations. There was a radio station called Radio City that had taken over a set of abandoned sea forts that were jutting out of the North Sea. And there was a disagreement between a Radio Atlanta owner, the chairman of it, and the guy who was running Radio City, Reg Calvert. And the other guy, Lord Smedley, shot Reg Calvert with the shotgun when Reg Calvert came to negotiate with him about getting, a transmitter back or something like that. And the fact that, like, these guys were now physically invading one another's ships and were shooting one another really kind of brought home that the fact that everybody had been calling it pirate radio for a while made it seem pirate, but not in the good kind of pirate. You know what I mean? Like the real life kind of pirate thing all of a sudden. And that forced the British government's hand.
Yeah, I think what I saw was that Smedley was trying to get another merger going and just grow this empire with Radio City, and offered up this transmitter to Calvert. It didn't work. Calvert didn't want to pay him for it, and so Smedley literally sent, like, in the dead of night, these guys to board the ship and get it back, like true pirate style.
Yeah.
And Calvert didn't take kindly to that, so he threatened him, went to his house, and was met with a shotgun.
I saw that he was not the type to threaten anybody, but that the Smedley's housekeeper tried to keep Calvert from entering, I guess, his study or his office or something. They got into a scuffle, and Smedley shot him with a shotgun.
Yeah, and got manslaughter. He, apparently claimed self-defense because, I don't know what the laws were like back then, but the guy did come to his house, and he claimed he felt threatened.
Yeah, and so he was ultimately acquitted. But the larger impact that it had on pirate radio in the UK is that Marine Broadcasting Offences Act, which you could get up to 2 years in the pokey for that, not to mention all the fines. And one of the things that they really kind of passed this law on was not like, oh, these guys are actually shooting each other now, we got to do something. It was this idea that their broadcast could interfere with marine distress signals.
Yeah.
And that is an ongoing, long-standing establishment government opposition to pirate radio. That's typically what they go to the public with, like, hey, you want to be out at sea trying to get help and some kids are spinning the WHO and nobody can hear you because your signal's being infringed on? We don't want that either. Let's all get rid of the pirate radio stations. But that doesn't seem to be the real reason why governments tend to oppose pirate radio. It's usually that they're protecting the interests of the corporations who have legitimate licenses and usually a lot more sway with the government than some kids who got their hands on a German merchant vessel and started broadcasting, 60s soul from it.
Yeah, and that's, we'll get to America today, but that's exactly how they frame it today as well.
Right.
Is that you're going to get in the way of legitimate signals of in case of distress. Because we won't go there yet. But O'Reilly keeps Radio Caroline going. His ship was seized by Dutch authorities, but he got it back. He kept it going. There were some, I think George Harrison gave them like a substantial check to keep it going because he believed in their mission in the 70s.
And Tom Jones chipped in a bunch of hash.
Of course he did, which is more valuable than money, as we all know.
Sure.
Both of the boats, the Caroline North and the South, had a couple of incidents. I think the Mi Amigo ran aground at one point and was repaired. And then the original Caroline, did a fire break out or did it sink?
No, sorry. So the Mi Amigo sank. The original Caroline, I don't know whatever happened to it. I could not find it. But I know for a fact that it wasn't the original ferry, the MV Caroline that sank. It was definitely the Mi Amigo.
Well, the Mi Amigo must have two then because it ran aground and was fixed.
Right, and then it sank later.
Afterward.
It did. It had a little bit of bad luck. What cracks me up in this entire story is that there was a German vessel called the Mi Amigo.
I know.
My friend in Spanish. It was a German merchant vessel.
Oh, wait.
I don't understand.
I think the Caroline is a museum now, so that one did survive, right?
No, the Ross's Revenge.
Oh, okay.
So they came up with another German ship, the Ross Revenge, to replace the Mi Amigo. And that one eventually has been outfitted to be a museum,
all right,
which I can't tell. They have a website, and it sounds like the last update was from 2014. And I don't know if it's actually open or not. If it is, they definitely need to update their website. But that's the plan, at least. I don't know if like they ran out of money or something like that.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different museums, but I would love to, on our next UK trip, go check these places out. That'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I can't wait to get back to the UK and Australia too, man.
Yeah, I think we had even sort of loosely earmarked this year or next year for another international trip. And, you know, I don't think that's going to happen.
That kind of fell through. And also, sorry, everybody, I'm also excited to get back to New Zealand too.
Yeah, because we didn't get enough time there.
Oh, wait. And Canada.
Well, we always love to go to Canada. That's easy.
Sure. Yep.
Should we take another break?
All the boxes. Yeah. Let's take a break.
All right.
Maybe we'll go to Germany next time, too.
I'd love to go to Germany. It's my homeland. Well, that's not true. We'll be right back.
Hey there, are you thirsty? Well, before you take a sip, have you stopped to think about what's in your water? Many conventional bottled waters contain PFAS, harmful substances known as forever chemicals. But you can drink water as clean as nature intended.
Richard's Rainwater collects 100% pure, refreshing drops of rain. Yes, it really is rain, everybody. This rain is caught clean before it hits the ground or becomes polluted with pesticides and contaminants commonly found in groundwater.
Yep, Richard's Rainwater is naturally pure with no need for harsh chemicals or additives. That means no added fluoride, no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing.
And you can enjoy the clean taste of Richard's still rainwater and the long-lasting cold-pressured bubbles of Richard's sparkling rainwater. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. And we even have a special offer, don't we, Josh?
Yeah, text STUFF to 2512928887, and you'll get $2 off a 12-pack case of Richard's Rainwater. Sip the sky. Hey there, everybody. Here's some bonus stuff you should know. This time, it's about traveling to Orlando for business. Orlando has tons of places to host your conferences and meetings. Dr. Michael Edwards, CEO of Ocean Insight, said it best. Orlando is as much a business capital as an entertainment one. And when the day is done, you can kick off each evening at one of 46 Michelin-rated restaurants. What's not to love? So check out Orlando, where the possibilities for business travel are unbelievably real. Learn more at OrlandoForBusiness.com.
By the way, I said Germany was my homeland because I took German in high school and college, speak German, and have been to Germany and love it. I'm not German in any way.
What's your ancestry?
It's fully, like I did the DNA test. It's fully like UK, Irish, uh-huh, sort of European. And then it said like 1% East African or something like that.
I got like 2% or 0.2%. Yeah, it was like, no, 0.002% Ashkenazi Jew.
Oh, nice.
And then I got 2% something Neanderthal.
This all checks out.
It does. It does, for sure. So I'm celebrating both of my heritages.
Shalom.
Thank you.
So
back at you, I think, is that?
Yeah, back at you.
Yeah.
So the U.S., we've kind of overlooked the United States. They didn't have nearly the sort of, I guess, cultural revolution that the U.K. had as far as pirate radio goes. Mm-hmm. They've had a few sort of operations here and there. The one that you were talking about, there was this preacher, Reverend Carl McIntyre. He was a fundamentalist who I think he broadcast from a ship for like 10 hours until there was a fire.
He worked so hard on it for months. He thought he was going to be up and running in a few days, maybe a couple of weeks. It ended up taking him months to get this pirate radio ship ready, and he got it going, and they shut him down in 10 hours. And we've talked about him before, actually, in our fairness doctrine.
Yeah,
because
that's
the whole
right.
reason that he was operating from a pirate radio station is he went from being broadcast on, like, I think 600-something radio stations across the South and the Midwest. And he would preach, like, anti-communism. He said the Catholic Church was fascist. He said Billy Graham was an appeaser. He was a real firebrand and also super political, too. And because of that fairness doctrine said you have to have equal airtime for opposing viewpoints, he didn't do that. So he kind of brought the heat on to some of these stations that were worried about losing their license. They started to drop him. So he tried pirate radio for a minute, and it didn't pan out very well for him.
He tried for 600 minutes.
That's right.
So
that's some fast math there, Chip.
Well, it's pretty easy. Where you see pirate radio in the United States, and it still continues today. In fact, there was one study that said there are more pirate radio stations in New York on the FM band than there were legit stations.
Yeah, and that's been going on for a while. I saw late 80s, early 90s, there was a big boom in pirate radio, and like the epicenter seems to have been New York.
It's because of Christian Slater.
I think so. Or maybe they wrote the movie because of the boom. I don't know.
Well, a lot of them are out of Brooklyn. They're broadcast from rooftops. You know, you get a little equipment, you get an antenna, and you're in business. And here's the deal with pirate radio in the United States and what's going on now, which is currently the FCC has popped up, of course. And they used to, like the article said, play kind of whack-a-mole, trying to mm-hmm. knock these things back as they came up. But mm-hmm. I guess they thought it was such a problem, especially in New York, that the FCC has, and especially this current FCC, has stood up and said, nope, not going to happen on our watch. And in January of this year, the president signed the, and I love it when they come up with an acronym that actually
really
works.
They really worked for this one.
They had to reverse engineer this one. The, mm-hmm. the Pirate Act, Preventing Illegal Radio Abuse Through Enforcement.
But also abuses in there, like stop abusing that radio center.
Yeah, but, you know, they needed an A.
For sure. I'm saying, like, hats off to that to them for that one.
It
that
couldn't be radio amusement through enforcement.
They actually, at least they used all the letters
yeah.
from all the words. I hate it when they just slip a couple of words in there, like nobody's going to notice. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's lazy.
So the problem with the Pirate Act is this. It takes already existing FCC laws that allow the FCC to kind of go after pirate radio stations and fine them. I saw you're looking at fines of something like $10,000 a day, typically with a maximum of about $75,000 for a total fine for operating an illegal pirate station. That's bad. I mean, most people who are operating pirate stations do so, as we'll talk about in a minute, because they don't have the money to run a legit station and pay all the fees and all the application fees and the license fees and all that stuff. So that is significant. What the Pirate Act does, it takes all those existing laws and just says, you're that $75,000 max fee, let's up that to $2 million.
Yeah.
And the whole point of that is to specifically intimidate people out of pirate radio, out of broadcasting pirate radio. And that's terrible, especially coming from an FCC that's led by a former telecommunications lobbyist and the guy who presided over the end of net neutrality. That's some sour grapes right there, if you ask me.
Yeah, and the whole deal with pirate radio these days, especially out of New York, is they're not just like spinning tunes for fun. I'm sure there are some that
some
do
of them
that.
Are. Yeah.
But a lot of it is are people starting these very small operations that maybe broadcast over their neighborhood because they are an underserved community as far as radio programming goes.
Right.
And they will speak in their native language to people who are listening in their native language, and they are getting news out to people in their native language. And these are communities that aren't represented on the regular FM spectrum. And there's a big argument to be made that this is almost like a public service in a way to these underserved
yes,
communities.
It absolutely is. And that's what radio has been. That's what's been intended for since the inception of it, at least in the United States. It's a, and in the UK, too. It's meant to be a public service. for everybody. The thing is in the U.S., we've long valued a multiplicity of different voices, of competing ideas and thoughts, of different music. I mean, even if you are talking about pirate radio stations that are just playing music, they're not doing, you know, anything. There's no, like, you know, community discussion or anything like that.
No.
The music they're playing is probably stuff you're not going to hear anywhere else on the radio.
Yes.
And there's definitely something that's lost when, you know, more and more radio stations become homogenized further and further. Then all of a sudden, it's kind of like the radio equivalent of that strip mall that you could go to Topeka,
right,
or Miami or Seattle and find the exact same stuff in the exact same stores with almost the exact same layout, to where it's all the same. That's what pirate radio represents. Or even if you take the pirate out of it, that's what a multiplicity of different community radio stations represents, the lack of homogeneity that kind of sucks the life out of everything. That in and of itself makes them valuable, and that they shouldn't be aggressively pursued. Or, Chuck, there's one other thing, too. If you are going to aggressively pursue this, then also make an avenue for legitimacy rather than just try to stamp them out, or else it really makes you question what the ultimate motive is.
Yeah, and here's the thing. Like, it'd be very easy to sit back and say, well, you've got the internet. You can have an internet radio station. You can have a podcast. It's more democratized than ever before to get your voice out there. Which is true in a way, but that's also a very privileged thing to say when you just assume that someone has the money to afford the internet.
Just go get a new iPhone. What's your problem?
Yeah, exactly. Like, just download the app. It's that easy. Radio.
I don't understand how you're not getting this.
Radio is free, and you can buy a radio. You probably have a radio if you're one of these people in an underserved community. But if you don't, you can get one at a thrift store for $5. That picks up the FM and AM spectrum, and
right,
you don't have to pay monthly fees. You don't have to pay internet fees. And it is a true democratized voice for the people who can't afford to get it otherwise.
Right. So, like, I didn't know anything about this as far as, like, the Pirate Act. I didn't know that existed until we started researching this episode. But it's very clear that this is a law that's creating outlaws, where there shouldn't
right
necessarily be outlaws. There's no inherent problem with pirate radio. Like, from what I've read, and granted, it was on a pirate radio organization's blog, Prometheus Radio Project, but they said you can find very few instances of pirate radio stations actually interfering
right
with other stuff. But you can very easily find major corporate radio stations interfering with stuff. And very frequently, say, there was an instance in the 90s where North Perry, Florida's airport had to change frequencies because the commercial radio station that was interfering with their frequency that they were using to communicate with airplanes, they wouldn't change their frequency. So the airport had to. You don't find
so
that
rare
with pirate radio stations. And from what I saw, there's a lot of self-policing that goes on in the community because you don't want to infringe on somebody
no
else's broadcast, because that means that their broadcast is going to infringe on your broadcast.
Yeah, you want your own digits.
Mm-hmm.
And America, like we said before, to reiterate, they're standing behind the same thing the BBC did, which is it can interfere with sharing of vital public safety information.
Right.
And it's just, that's such hooey. Like, if someone dropped a dirty bomb on New York City, they're sure the radio stations might issue some sort of public safety alert. But I guarantee you, so would the pirate radio stations, and they would do so in their language.
That's true.
You know?
That's right. Yeah, because there's a lot of evidence that pirate radio stations serve immigrant communities because they have, like, kind of this cultural tie to radio as a technology. So when they come over here to the United States, they expect to get their information from radio.
Yeah, and they wouldn't, like, the Twin Towers fall. I guarantee you pirate radio stations weren't like, we're just going to keep spinning the tunes. You know, I'm sure they did, like every other broadcast and TV show and radio show in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they ceased their programming and started handing out vital information.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I can't prove it, but I can't imagine that they did otherwise.
I like what you did there, too. You, like, they're like, well, what are you going to do? I mean, pirate radio interferes with stuff. You're like, oh, yeah, what are you going to do if there's a dirty bomb in New York? You just threw it right back in the FCC's face.
I don't even know what a dirty bomb is.
The thing is from what I've seen, small government conservatives and libertarians should be all over that Pirate Act. They should be very much up in arms about this and about the way that the FCC targets small illegal radio stations without offering like a legitimate path to legitimacy. And I would like to see that.
That's right. And by the way, I have an in-show correction. I think I said that preacher's boat caught fire. I don't think it actually caught fire. I think it just started smoking because the antenna feeder line interfered with another radio station. So, didn't actually catch fire when he was, because I thought the ironies of preaching fire and brimstone and it actually catching fire was too great.
You're right. God went, be quiet.
It was just smoke.
So, if you are interested in pirate radio, The Verge did a whole series on it. Really interesting, in-depth stuff. And you could also do, I ran across one called The Lot. It's out of, I think, Williamsburg, and it's on a little lot in a shipping container.
Of course it is.
And it's like all DJ sets all the time, but it sounded pretty great. And they have a webcam of what you can see out the window. It's just cute, nice, and it's just cozy in a way.
Yeah, and again, go check out and stream the Radio Caroline classic version. Mm-hmm. If you're into like just good playlist, it's one of the best.
I got to check that out. I didn't run across that. So thank you for that public service, Chuck. You got anything else?
Nope.
Okay, well, that's it for Pirate Radio for now. And that means it's time for listener mail.
This is called Hot Off the Presses. Just got this email, and it was just so heartwarming. I had to share it. Hey, guys, and Jerry, I love listening to the recent episode on soap. I consider myself a bit of a soap nerd because when I served at the Peace Corps, as a Peace Corps volunteer in Senegal for 3 years, late 2000s, I guess, 2016 to 2019, late teens, my main activity was training women's groups on how to start small businesses making and selling soap. We trained them on how to make all kinds of bar soap using local ingredients, shea butter, honey, mint, herbs. Teaching these women's groups about soap making is a really excellent way to improve their household financial security for a few reasons. First, you're always going to have a market for soap because everyone needs it. Secondly, there are a few barriers to entry to making soap. You don't need to be able to read or have fancy equipment. If you can measure, pour, and stir, then you can make it. And thirdly, because women in Senegal are responsible for so much of the daily chores in their homes, soap making requires only a little bit of time since much of the process is waiting for the soap to cure fully into a hard bar. And fourth, making soap is a great way to teach all the basics of starting a business. Marketing, accounting, record keeping, calculating unit costs, profit margins, making creative packaging. Once they master these skills, they can expand to other business opportunities.
And fifth, it smells really good.
Yeah, she said some of her fondest memories are her service, seeing the satisfaction on their faces as the lye and shea butter mixture spent ages stirring by hand became real soap for them to sell and market.
Cool.
I trained over 150 members of more than 5 women's groups on soap making, and all of the groups continue to make soap and sell it for a profit today, helping make their households more financially secure.
Tell me they included a website.
No, because it's a bunch of different groups, but it is.
Oh, okay.
It was from the Peace Corps, so you obviously want to support them. And that is from Grace E. Nagel.
Thanks a lot, Grace E. Nagel. We appreciate that. That was great. That was a great email.
She sent pictures.
But also, we appreciate. We'll have to check them out. We appreciate what you did over there in Senegal too.
Totally.
If you want to let us know about something great you did in your life, like Grace E. did, you can send us an email. Wrap it up, spank it on the bottom twice, and send it off to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Are you thirsty? Well, Richard's rainwater is caught clean before it even hits the ground. Rain is naturally pure, so there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. Richard's rainwater contains no chlorine, no forever chemicals, No microplastics, no nothing. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of still rainwater or the cold pressured bubbles of sparkling rainwater. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. And for a coupon, text STUFF to 251-292-8887 and receive $2 off a 12-pack case of Richards Rainwater. Hey, if you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon as low as $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Use promo code STUFF20 to receive $20 off your first month for listening to this podcast. Switch now at Visible.com. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. The Visible monthly rate is $25 per month.